So where we are so far is we've read two different stories. In each of those stories, a character or a group of characters has a supernatural barrier to death removed voluntarily. In the first case, the people of Luz voluntarily walk outside the city, which protects them against the angel of death. In the second, a woman who apparently was immortal because, or at least was living a very long time because she went to shul every morning, stopped going to shul, and therefore died. In each of those cases, what we said is that taken as narrative, what they tell us is that life seems not always to be an unalloyed good, but the moves that the Tzitz Eliezer makes in order to prevent them having halachic implications are convincing, and that it's clear they do have right. They are talking about supernatural cases. In the first case, it's not clear they are talking about Jews, and one can see how one can prevent them from having straightforward halachic implications. But they are all about death and whether death is valuable or whether life is always valuable or not, and that can be taken as a normative basis. Now, this week's story is going to be a little bit more problematic in that regard. What I want to do is first tell you the story as it would appear in halachic context. Which is we're just going to take the story about death. And then we're going to take that story and put it back into its original literary context and see if at the end of it the story has anything to do with that at all. And see what that tells us about the use of narrative in legal context. We may not finish the whole story today because the full story is very, very long. The halachic story is really very straightforward. Rabbi Judah the Prince, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, is ill with some kind of intestinal illness, which causes constant diarrhea. Nonetheless, as in the version that we have in the Bavli, which is all we're doing this week, the rabbis do not wish to see him die, so they pray for his continued life. His maidservant, who is one of the famous women of the Talmud, who is generally taken as halachically authoritative, initially prays for the right for his continued life, but when she sees the degree of his suffering, she shifts and prays for his death. And this becomes the basis of a long halachic discussion about whether it is permissible to pray for someone else's death. And then in turn, then we have a discussion about whether praying for someone's death implies the fact that you can, if you decide that you can pray for people's death on some occasion, does that mean that we thereby decide that those lives are not ones we have an obligation to preserve? And if that means that we don't have an obligation to preserve those lives, does that mean that we can also act in some, assuming that we define the action or limit the action in some particular way, can we occasion their death as well? That's the story the way it appears in halachic context. Here's the story the way it, right, we're going to read the story as it exists in narrative context and see if that's what we think the story is about at all. So starting from page one, okay? So this is on Ketubah 103b. There has been a lot of work lately about the extent to which narratives in the Talmud appear are thematically connected to the halachic context in which they appear. Right? The Talmud is organized around the Mishnah. The Mishnah is almost always given a legal structure, and the Mishnah is itself almost exclusively legal. And therefore, narratives in the Talmud can't be put in narrative context of the Mishnah most of the time. Right? They have to be connected to law at some point. But now there is a tendency to try and find a thematic connection between the narrative and the law. Sometimes I think it's really very compelling. Sometimes not so. In this case, I don't have an immediately thematically compelling story, but connection. But just to tell you, the halachic context here is the extent to which widows have rights in their dead husband's property. And particularly, they have the right to remain in their dead husband's house as opposed to leaving. Now, in the Yerushalmi, the segue into our story is the deathbed decree of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi that his sons should not eject his widow from the house. But in the Bavli, it is not taken quite so narrowly. Instead of his saying that what should happen is that they should not eject her from the house, what happens in this story is we have opening introduction when Rebbe was dying. He takes a long time to die. So we have this. We have a formalized dialogue between Rebbe and a series of other characters, in which you follow a formula in which he says, "I need somebody." Those people come in, and then Rebbe says something in a sort of oracular terms, right? He speaks it in very formal language. And the way I typed it, it's really poetry as opposed to prose. And then we play the game of trying to figure out what it is he meant. Okay, so here, the first time Rebbe's dying, so whoever is there, he says, "I need my sons." And his sons come in, and he says to them the following five things. Number one, be careful of your mother's honor. Secondly, the candle should be lit in its accustomed place. The table should be lit in its accustomed place. The bed should be made in its usual place. And Yosef of Haifa and Shimon of Ephrat, they serve me in my lifetime, and they will serve me in my death.
Okay.
Okay. So what does he mean by that? So the first thing the Talmud does is talks about why does Rebbe have to give them a command to be careful with their mother's honor? Because we all know that in fact there's a biblical obligation to honor your mother. And we are now treating Rabbi Nasi's deathbed declaration as ethical will, so to speak. Under the same rules as we treat halachic text, which is that we don't allow redundancy. Right? Whereas we might argue, right, if we were in a normal narrative context, that in ethical wills people take things that everyone knows that they have to do and just give them higher priority. The Talmud assumes that Rabbi Nasi, on his deathbed, sort of speaks Mishnaic language. So everything has to be legally essential. And as a result of that, the Talmud comes to the conclusion that what he's really telling them is, he's not telling them to respect their mother, even though it's the language that he says is be careful of your mother's honor. Really, he's talking about their stepmother, his second wife, and they come to the halachic conclusion that step-parents only need to be honored during the biological parent's lifetime, and therefore you would have thought that because he was dying, that they no longer have an obligation to respect their stepmother. So he's telling them, no, I command you to respect your stepmother regardless. Along the way, the text that Talmud cites to prove that one is obligated in the honor of step-parents in their parent's lifetime is in the biological parent's lifetime, it also includes a verse which requires honoring elder siblings, or at least oldest brothers, depending on how narrowly or broadly you read the text. And that may have some thematic significance later on. One of the issues that interests me on an ongoing basis is the extent to which tangents in Talmudic narrative are thematically significant or are just the product of, we need to just put this in here. In at least one text, I think I've shown that the tangents are actually critical to the theme. I don't know that I can make that as a general statement. Okay, so that's statement one. The second series of statements he makes, which the Talmud treats together and I would as well, is that the candle should remain lit in its accustomed place, the table should remain set in its accustomed place, the bed should remain made in its accustomed place. So just taking those three things, right, what is that saying? Why is he picking those three things? Why would he say those three things?
The position of his wife after he died, because assuming that she's the one who's responsible for, more of a reason to keep her around.
That's an interesting argument. I hadn't thought of that. That's very interesting. Yes, Deborah.
I agree with that. Benedating is the first thing that another woman would do if you bring her into the house. Saying you can't move the furniture around does something to...
Interesting. That's a very interesting reading, both of you, which I had not thought of at all. So I'm going to offer something else, but we'll see if you find yours more convincing. Yes, Brandon.
The candle is very...
Who says it's a Shabbat candle? Although we'll see. It will be taken, traditionally, as referring to the light which was left on Friday nights.
Further, it's
okay. Joseph, what do you want to say?
I would think that it might have something to do with not giving him more honor in death than he had. You should do everything as you did before.
Aha. Okay. Very interesting. Shouldn't think my death is going to change things for you. Okay, what about the last one? My servants in life should be my servants in death. So now that could certainly be read, right, the way you guys are reading it, that it means that he's not only keeping his wife's position, but he's making sure that everybody who serves him in life should have the right to serve him in death as well. Okay. Let's see how the Talmud handles it. Right, the Talmud says, what's the meaning of having the candle, the table, and the bed in their accustomed places? So Talmud says, Kol Beis Shimshi. Now, it's not clear what Beis Shimshi means. It literally means house of the sun. But we would think it means Ben HaShmashot. What do you think it means, Deborah? No, that's because Kol Beis Shimshi HaAsi LeBeis, it's a time. It has to be a time. So Kol Beis Shimshi, Rashi says it refers to twilight, Ben HaShmashot, and that specifically refers to Friday nights, because it's when people are sensitive to twilight, because when Shabbat comes. I don't know how convincing the etymology is. But Rashi derives this, so apparently, Rebbe used to come to his house every Friday night after his death. He would come back Friday night. In a version found in Sefer Chassidim, but not in the Talmud, not only did he come to his house on Friday night, but he made Kiddush. And he made Kiddush in a way which was for the entire family. He was motzi, right? He fulfilled everyone's obligation by making Kiddush. Yes, he's dead. But the Sefer Chassidim, you know, this is one of the great sources for the contemporary claims that tzaddikim aren't really dead when they're dead. Now, the interesting thing is that the Yerushalmi begins its discussion of Yud Nasi by using the line, once you die, you become free of all commandments. And they quote this story as part of an issue that doesn't show up in the Bavli at all about burial shrouds. If we get into the Yerushalmi, we may parallel it. But in the Bavli, there's none of this. The Bavli doesn't mention Kiddush. It just says he used to come to his house every Friday night. Halo Beis Shimsha, one Friday night. So apparently in the text as we have it, this happened for a number of Friday nights. There's an alternate text in which it happens the first Friday night. But the implication seems to be that the reason that he kept these things going was because he wanted the house to be familiar when he came to it, not to preserve his wife's honor, but because he wanted things kept the same. But one Friday night he came home. Yes. One Friday it's spookier when he makes Kiddush. We don't have that one.
No, I think it's spookier though. He's keeping the bed the same.
Ah, okay, so we'll get there in a moment. So he comes home Friday night, and a neighbor, right, so a neighbor comes, Kakaria Bava, and she comes knocking at the door. And so the maidservant, whom we'll see showing up again later, right, praying, says to the woman at the door, shh, Rebbe's here. Don't disturb him, apparently. And so now Rebbe stops coming, Shalola Hutzi La'az Al Rishonim. So as not to spread malicious statements about his predecessors. Now, Shalol Hotzi Laz Al Rishonim is a statement with important halachic context. It means you can't change anything about divorce documents, lest people suspect that earlier divorce documents which didn't have this improvement are invalid. That's why, for example, we are not allowed to write divorce documents on parchment nowadays, because we always used to write divorce documents on parchment, and then at some point parchment became too expensive, so they switched to paper. And so you're not allowed to switch back, because then we're afraid if you start writing divorce documents on parchment, people will look at the old paper ones and say those must be invalid. Other contexts where it shows up, more controversially in contemporary times, are banning smoking, which I think, particularly in Chassidut, is very difficult, because you have so many stories about the Baal Shem Tov, the founder, smoking his pipe. And if you were now claim that smoking is halachically legitimate, that would imply that the Baal Shem Tov regularly engaged in halachically forbidden acts, even if accidentally. And that's very hard. And other context is in terms of responses to women's changing role, is I think my personal position is that one has to be very careful not to make claims, not to argue for change on the grounds that up until now all women lived spiritually empty lives. You can argue that change is necessary now, you can argue so that things are better for a lot of people, but you can't make a claim that depreciates great people in the past. So the question is, what is Rabbi Nasi, apparently, because once the neighbors find out, so we believe that the neighbors find that once the neighbors know that he comes back, that will be motzilaz al rishonim. So what malicious rumors is he spreading about the past?
They didn't come back. They didn't merit to come back.
They didn't merit to come back.
They didn't merit or they didn't bother?
Or they didn't bother. I don't know.
I mean, they could have come back and then we would have known.
Okay, but now that we know this story, right, which right?
Let's see, laws on his poor maidservant who wants him to look like a fool when she can't demonstrate that he's actually told the truth. We would institutionalize people for that kind of claim.
Unless this term that is taken to be Friday night.
Yeah.
Isn't actually Friday night. If it's talking about that time when a person is on the verge, perhaps hovering between, seems to come back a little bit and fades a little bit. I think that way it could be seen as something that perhaps is a little bit less kooky and perhaps more graspable. I don't know how.
So why can't the neighbors find out? If he's just going in and out of consciousness, why can't the neighbors find out?
What's the malicious thing about it?
Okay, so point one we need
to... I don't know.
All right, so point one we need to make is that the genre here is magical realism. So we can't worry so much about being spooked.
Mm-hmm.
Right, if you've read Gabriel Garcia Marquez, right, that's where we are. We're in a particular genre of fiction in which the supernatural is treated as natural naively. Right, in the context of the narrative, it may very well be the audience knows perfectly well that this is spooky, but you have to engage in a willing suspension of disbelief and not see these things as spooky. They just happen. Now, giving that, right, granted that, and I think that's where we are, that we're in a magical realist narrative. So let's think again, why does he ask specifically for his candle, his table, and his bed? I want to suggest that what this tell you is, right, and let's remember that he prepared for this, right, before his death, he knows that he wants his candle, his table, and his bed. And what that means is, I think, that the candle represents his capacity to learn, and the table and the bed represent his physical desires. And it means that he's not planning for a death which changes anything. This is made more extreme in the Sefer Chassidim, where in fact he's not only the one thing that we would think death has to change, which is your relationship to commandments. No, he comes back and he does mitzvahs, which is going to be important later in the narrative. But I think that the simplest way of reading this story is that he is prepared for a death in which he is still there, in which he still has desires, and he's telling you, I'm going to die, but nothing should change. Ah, that's a very important question. And that is why I think when we get through it, it's not at all clear to me that this narrative tells us anything about death, tells anything about death as opposed to life. Because, right, this narrative may be telling us, maybe interested in an entirely different question about death than whether ordinarily death is better than life under some circumstances. Now, it doesn't work, though. Because, right, now, particularly if you take the version of the text that he's planning this, and the very first Friday night, right, to discover that he can't do it, and he has to leave. So the whole, right, so if you take that version, or even the version we have, where at some point it stops, so 3 out of 5 of his deathbed commandments turn out to be wasted. If the reason they kept the candle, the table, and the bed was so that he would feel comfortable when he comes back, and it turns out that because they can't let anybody else find out that he can't come back, so this becomes a sort of tragic narrative, right, in which his own, right, in which all his expectations of death are destroyed. Now we can connect this to a whole series of narratives, questions about whether the extent to which certain things are possible only in private. And I might argue, I do argue regularly that in the story of Noah in Bereshit, in which Noah gets drunk. So the question is, why does Noah get drunk? And the answer that I prefer is that Noah gets drunk because he believes that he can be Adam again. Connecting this by the Midrash, which says that the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil is the grape, and what Chava does to Adam is she gets him drunk. And so what Noah is trying to do is sort of homeopathic medicine. He plans to get drunk again, because by getting drunk he can forget the difference between good and evil, and he can go back to being Adam before the sin. And it fails It fails because Ham comes in. And the question is, does Ham see what really is there, and the whole thing was a sham, and all Noah was a naked guy rolling around in a tent? Right? And this way, and the argument is, you can't, once you have gained knowledge, you cannot again become innocent. Or is it the correct reading that he, in fact, could have, so long as there was no one else there? But once someone else was there, he became self-conscious. Right? And innocence is only possible in the absence of self-consciousness. So here you have the same problem. Right? It might have been that Rabbi Hanasi could have ignored death. But the presence of somebody else made him where this is, I think in contemporary cinema, right, the metaphor for this is Wile E. Coyote looking down. Mm. right, there's certain things you can, right, that you can do as long as you're not aware that you're doing them. And the existence of somebody else made it that essential. Okay, so I want to set that out as issue number one. We'll now discover that the first halachic statement that Talib makes is exactly the same thing. Right, what he said is, I want you to respect your mother as if I were alive. So all his, right, so it turns out that all five of his deathbed commands were, nothing should change when I'm dead. And if we take the bed as straightforwardly symbolic, and we recall that great scholars are obligated to come home and have relations with their wives on Friday nights.
As a minimum.
But that seems to have been the norm also in Talmudic times. So then it makes perfect sense why you should respect, right, my wife the same way she was when she's alive, because who said she stopped being my wife? And we have all sorts of interesting halachic questions. If they do have children, if they didn't, can't she remarry? If they didn't have children, would she be obligated in Yibum? Since they have children, it doesn't come out.
They have more children, are they legitimate?
this is a variant of...
Can children sleep with dead people?
This is a variant of the Eshet Eliyahu. The wife of Elijah question. Okay. So now we go on to the servants who are who he says should serve. They serve me in life. So they should serve me in death. So apparently the rabbis initially thought that meant that what he meant was they would be his pallbearers. But it turns out that the servants die before he does. At which point they realize that no, he didn't mean that they'll be his pallbearers. He meant that they should, right, that they're going to serve him when he's dead, the same way they serve him when he's alive, but apparently he can't have live servants when he's dead. So he has to have dead servants. Deborah and I had a conversation earlier this week when I was a kid, I won a book in a contest called On Wings of Prayer, and there was a story there which upsets Deborah very much. I'm ambivalent about it, in which there's a great chazan who was a choir leader, and they sing together for years and years and years, and they're very famous. And then one day the chazan dies, say on a Tuesday, and on Friday night, just before Shabbat, the choir leader comes home and tells his wife, the chazan has been honored with the Kabbalat Shabbat in Gan Eden, and he needs me to lead the choir. And he lies down in his bed and dies. Right, so you have this notion. Now, other people instinctively start thinking of clay figures buried in the Egyptian sarcophagi.
No, I was also thinking about real live clay being buried alive in many cultures.
So I have to figure out, where the resonances that you feel in this story are. But you'll see that there's a pattern here, right? So the rabbis initially misunderstand what he meant, and it's only made clear, and then they have to figure out the reason that he said this. Why do you have to bother mentioning it? So because he was afraid, again, of laws, of malicious rumors, he was afraid that people would say, you know what, really they deserve to die a long time ago. And the only thing that kept them alive was the merit of serving Rebbe. And now he's gone, so they're dead. So he says, no, you should understand that they're going to die, but they're not going to die because they don't deserve to live. They're going to die because they're honored with serving me. So he mentions this in order to protect their honor. So the Talmud is consistently putting in that notion of protecting other people's honor. Okay, so now we have, right, the story in which he gives these initial...
I don't understand why that should be protecting their honor. For them to die because their job is to serve him,
right,
he dies.
So they haven't... Yes, because otherwise people would think that the reason they died as soon as he died is because he was the only thing that kept them alive.
Which protects their honor, right? I mean, to say that they really had so much regard for this man that they really tried to outdo themselves you buy 10 years.
So you're thinking naturalistically, right? They're thinking that, you know, if people die, it must be they sinned. And if you die immediately after someone else dies, it implies that you were just living vicariously. You didn't really deserve to live on your own. So he's reversing that and saying, no, it's not that they didn't deserve to live on their own, it's that they, merited dying so they could serve me. There's a little bit of arrogance, except of course we recall that when Rebbe dies elsewhere, it is declared that all modesty in the world vanishes. He's the last modest man. So we have to play. We have to play with that. Yes.
All of these are extremely. Uh-huh. I'm going to die, but you know, you're.
But he's not really going to die. That's the thing.
No. But no, he thought he was going to die.
In this country, you can host your children to do what you want after you're gone.
But given standing trajectory for your servants, you know.
Oh, I find that disturbing.
Yes.
So, you are required to honor your parents after their death. It's not at all clear that honoring includes obedience at all, which is what we talked about last year, right?
Yeah.
So I would qualify it that way. There is an obligation to honor parents, which is reflected in formal modes, as to, like the way in which you refer to them, the extent to which obedience is ever a part of it, and then whether that carries over is not clear. But there is an obligation to obey anyone's deathbed command. Because that way we think it makes people feel better on their deathbed if they know that they will be obeyed afterwards. So we call it Tzava'at Shchiv Mara, right? A command of the dying is generally legally binding, and we derive this from the habit that Yaakov and Moshe have calling the children of Bnei Yisrael together before they die, and seeing that seems to be an opportune moment in which people are emotionally vulnerable.
Well, hold on a second. We may see that you're supposed to give instructions when you die from that. But show me where anybody ever followed those instructions.
Okay.
So except the carrying of Yosef's bones out of me.
Yes, that does work. And of Yaakov's bones.
But that is an oath.
Okay.
In both of those cases, it's an oath.
True. Okay. Okay, so now he's done with the initial instructions which he gives to the sons. So now he says, "L'chachmei Yisrael ani tzarich." I now I need the sages. So all the sages march in. And he gives them again a set of instructions. He says, first of all, al tispiduni ba'ayarot, don't eulogize me in the ayarot, which are the intermediate cities. There are three categories of city. There is the kfar, which is the village, the ayar, which we might call the township, and the ir, which is the city. So he says, I don't want eulogies in the intermediate cities.
That is a
krach. Yeah, you can also say, sorry, krach would be the correct, sorry, yeah. It's Kfar, Yir, and Krach. And then he says, V'hoshivu yeshiva la'achar shloshim yom, which is generally understood here to mean not that one should establish a new yeshiva in my name after 30 days, but that after 30 days, you can go back to having a regular yeshiva. And during the first 30 days, he wanted the academy closed. But his assumption is that they would otherwise have kept it a lot longer. So he's telling them, no, after 30 days, you have to put the yeshiva back. And then he gives instruction, Shimon b'ni Chacham, Shimon my son, that could be just stating he is wise, although it's a straightforward thing would be that there is a role called the Chacham, which is a role in the Sanhedrin, which we know that Rabbi Meir, I forget who it is, at the end of Horiot, there's somebody has the official position of Chacham. So probably it was that, yes. Could be. Mm-hmm. Could be. It seems to be more likely that it means the title Chacham, but I'm open to either way. It doesn't matter, because they're going to reread it anyway. Gamliel b'ni Nasi, but Gamliel, right, Gamliel, my son, is the Nasi. Chanina Barchama, who is utterly unrelated. Yoshev Barosh is the academic head. And he's the head of the academy. Okay, so now having disposed of his personal things, now he disposes of the political. He talks about how he's going to be mourned publicly, and who will take over his positions. Apparently he held all three positions, or at least he held two of them. He was the Nasi and the Yoshev Barosh. So, Altis Beduni Ba'ayarot, what does that mean? So they thought that he was trying to be nice to people, and say, you know what, in the middle cities, nobody has to bother coming to eulogize me, just in the big cities. But then they discover that what happens is that everybody from everywhere comes to the big cities, and when he ends up with these massive eulogy crowds, and they figure out, that's probably what he wanted. He was doing it in order to He was doing it in order to have to have more honor rather than less. Although the Yerushalmi reads this somewhat differently, that seems to be the straightforward reading of the Bavli. Okay, what about restoring the yeshiva after 30 days? So that he derives because Moses, there's a text which seems to imply that Moses was eulogized for 30 days without restoring the yeshivot, and after 30 days they restored the yeshivot for half a day. And so he's humble, so he does not think that he should be eulogized more than Moses.
Yeah, but
not less either, that's correct. not less either. Okay, now we get to, now we get an interruption in the narrative. Now one of the things that is interesting to see that the narrative is a composite. You have really three elements in the way the Talmud tells the story. You have a Hebrew narrative, which is fairly consecutive, which is what everything is strung around. You have commentary on the Hebrew narrative, which is usually halachic, right? Halachic things like, you know, do you really have to respect your mother, right? Your father's wife and stuff like that. And then you have a different set of Aramaic narratives, which are not part of the same narrative consecutively, but which seem to be part of an entirely different tradition, but are interjected into the Hebrew narrative. So here we have the first of the Aramaic interjections. It says, on the day that Rebbe died...
Back to on Friday nights?
You're right. The coming back Friday nights was the first one. You're right. So there is an interesting project to try and take it apart and see if you can figure out whether the Aramaic narrative really existed independently or really is a parallel tradition or interpretive tradition of the Hebrew narrative, continually putting these in. So the Deborah's right, the thing about him coming home every Friday night, which we say then with the expansion of in parallel but later texts about it being Kiddush. The second one is how Yom Adashkafti the Rebbe, that day on which Rebbe died. So Nafka Bat Kala V'Amra. So a heavenly voice came out. And the heavenly voice said, "Kol dahava bashkafti the Rebbe mizuman v'luchayor lamaba." Anybody who is at the death of Rebbe is prepared. Presumably, they have a guaranteed seat for eternal life. Okay, so Rebbe's death is the source of eternal life. You just have to be there. Then we have the character Ahu Koves. I translated Koves as a washerman. For some reason, Sansina believes it's a fuller, and I have the faintest idea what a fuller is.
Fuller?
A fuller, F-U-L-L-E-R. Do you know what a fuller is? I think it shows up in Chaucer also. Look it up. I don't know exactly what a fuller is. I presume it is something to do with washing, but I don't know what. But a koves is also in a text in Sukkah in which the Talmud lists the comprehensive curriculum of the well-rounded rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who has the complete curriculum. So he learns, he learns everything from the great to the small. And taking the straightforward reading of the Talmud, the great things involve all sorts of complicated intellectual disciplines. And the little things include things like Aesop's fables, which are described as Mishalot Shualim, parables about foxes, and Mishalot Kovsim, which are parables. I don't think they're parables about washermen. What I think is they're the parables of washermen. Okay, a fuller is a person who cleans and thickens freshly woven cloth. Okay, thank you, Chanoel. So I think that Kovsim represent in the Talmud a certain type of folk tradition. In another narrative, the deposition of Rabban Gamliel, so I think when I rewrote it as a play, so I have the Koves speaking Cockney. And right in there, the Koves has a very particular form of enigmatic lower class speech, and I think that's what a Koves means to somebody not of the intellectual classes. So there's a Koves who apparently used to visit Rebbe every day. Whether that meant that he used to pick up cleaning, or it meant that he used to come to the public shiur, which Rabbi Yehuda Nasi used to give every morning, because we know elsewhere that Rabbi Nasi was so busy all day giving public lectures that he was allowed to only say the first verse of the Shema. And he would do that, the way they gave public lectures was by saying something to your repeater, and your repeater would shout it out. So he would just quickly say the first verse after he got a sentence out to the repeater, and then he could say something else, right? And then he could say something else. So he was. So it could be the filler came to his daily shiur. Whatever it is, that day he doesn't come. That day he doesn't come. So it came on the Shamahachi, when he hears that there was a bas kol which said anybody who was present at Rebbe's death gets a lom haba. What he does is, salik le'igra, he goes up to the roof, v'nafala ara, and he falls to the ground. Sounds like it's deliberate. Vamit, and he dies. So here we have a suicide. Now, suicides are not supposed to be buried, right? And having committed a crime that sounds like, that is homicide, we wouldn't expect that they go anywhere but heaven. Instead, a heavenly voice comes out, and I can't figure out why the previous heavenly voice was introduced in Aramaic and this one in Hebrew, but it's true in all manuscripts, so I don't know what this is doing in all of a sudden in Hebrew, and says, you know what, that Koves also, he gets Olam Haba. So now we have to put this, however we read the story of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi and the maidservant praying for him later, we have to realize that there's an earlier element of the story in which somebody flat out commits suicide, for reasons either of loyalty or emotional distress, and is rewarded with a heavenly voice telling him that he goes straight to heaven. And it's very hard to imagine that the point of the story is to valorize, the point of the whole narrative is to valorize suicide. Right? So to take this story, so it's not clear at all that we should be taking the story of the maidservant later as having halachic implications, unless we're going to try and derive from here that there are occasions in which under severe emotional stress, suicide becomes valorized. Now we will see in the next story we read also, right, in next week or 2 weeks, that this is actually part of a genre in rabbinic literature as well, is of the bit character who commits suicide, right, and is praised for doing so.
The what
character? The bit character. You know, somebody doesn't, you know, his only role is, he's like the security guard in Star Trek, his role is to die. The security guard, right? Wearing red in the opening scene means you're dead.
A quick question here: didn't come that day, the day that the rabbi died. So presumably, one is he wasn't there, but it wasn't the death experience, but the metaphysics.
Yes.
He's upset about.
He's upset that
preparation for life after.
Yeah, he's upset because he thinks he lost eternal life by not being there at the death, and so he killed. So he decided that this life is not worth having if he's not, right, since he lost his chance at eternal life, and by giving up this life, he gets his eternal life back.
Perhaps there's a way to explain why the language changes.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's a clarification. That is to say, he hears that whoever was there, is a grant of eternal life. So he figures he'll go for that eternal life. Why not start it now if it's eternal? Might as well. And perhaps that's not necessarily so clear. So there's a new little tag at the end that says, in case you were wondering, he gets eternal life also. He's included. So being there, it doesn't necessarily have to mean being there.
You have to be emotionally there.
Or, you know, perhaps olam hazeh means being there. Perhaps it covers a broader range than, you know, the limits of four walls.
Okay, but why does that explain the shift in language?
Well, because that's not necessarily... Before you get to that sentence, the story is very ambiguous in terms of his motivation, does it work?
You think, you know, somebody added this on because it wasn't clear?
Or because that somebody felt that one particular explanation had more...
Okay,
had
so
more,
that's interesting that it could be that originally the story just ends with him committing suicide and it's a tragic story and somebody tacks on the black hole.
It could be seen as a tragic story.
Okay, I can. That's interesting. I don't have a better explanation, so I'll have to go with it for now. That's a very good question. Do you see Olam Haba as a rare thing? Mm-hmm. We have both, you know, in Yeshaya and in Talmud places which seem to imply that getting into Olam Haba is rare. But we also have lots which seem to follow the standard American position, which I believe is that 93% of Americans believe in hell, and 1% believe that they're going there or something. Right, Time Magazine, Time Magazine runs these polls regularly with these really astonishing statistics. So it may be that I think there are rabbinic statements which are much more cheerful. Like we go around saying Kol Yisrael Yesh Lehem Chelek V'Olam Haba, right? Mm. All Jews have a share in the world to come. And we have a list of a few people. A few people is not a terribly big list. Okay. Let's leave that for now. My purpose right now is just to point out that Rebbe's death is not the only death. And putting it in the context of the other death changes the meaning of the later death. And we now really have two qualifications to Rebbe's death. One is he doesn't expect really to die. And secondly, we're in a universe in which suicide can be normative. And so we have to figure out whether in this magical realist universe, normal law applies, or in a universe in which the dead can come back and perhaps make kiddush, you can't judge death in the same way that you would in the normal world. Okay, so now we have some interesting byplay. He says, Shimon Vini, my son, is the Chacham. What do you mean by that? So the answer the Talmud gives, I'm not quite clear why they have to say this, is that even though Shimon, my son, is wiser, right, so they reinterpret Chacham from a title to being an adjective, Gamliel nonetheless is Nasi. So this brings us into a fun byplay in which Levi, who was another rabbi at the time, says, duh, Gamliel the oldest, why shouldn't he be Nasi? And Rabbi Shimon, the one who doesn't get to be Nasi, responds by saying something quite vicious to Levi. He refers to another story, which we don't need to get into, in which Levi does something wrong in his prayer posture. He does something to an extreme which is not taken as appropriate because it's seen as forcing God's hand. Possibly there's a lot of difficulty figuring out exactly what Levi does wrong. And therefore Levi limps. And so Rabbi Shimon says, it's necessary for both you and your limp, which is just a gratuitous dig. Okay, so now the Talmud says, gee, okay, but why was it really necessary to tell it after all, right? Right? After all, there is a verse which says that we do in fact believe in primogeniture. Although this is, of course, very, very strange because there are many, many other verses in which we clearly don't believe in primogeniture of titles. That's what all Genesis is about, is shifting. Right, shifting from the younger to the older son and all the way through Exodus, in which Moses is the younger son. So that because we have one verse in 2 Kings in which somebody gives the kingdom to an oldest son, whereas Solomon isn't the oldest son, right? It's a very strange thing for the Talmud to just say naively, gee, isn't it obvious that we give the reign to the oldest son? But taking that as a given, so we say that we only give the kingdom to the oldest son when the oldest son is the most fit replacement for the parent. Now this notion that rules of succession only apply on the assumption of equivalent talent has really interesting halachic implications nowadays, because it is the way out of almost all disqualifications for public office. When the state of Israel was founded, and so people had to deal with formal convictions against women and converts and other people having public positions and justifying participating in elections, even though candidates were running and religious parties were running candidates who should halachically be prevented from having such positions. So the way out of it is to claim that all such restrictions apply only when the candidates are equally qualified. Presumably, when you have an election, the reason you're voting for one candidate over the other is that you believe that candidate is more qualified. And therefore, practically, all such restrictions are eliminated. That was a purely formal disqualification, telling people that if, in fact, you can't make up your mind, you should vote for the other one. Right? But it has no actual political consequences. Okay?
What is smicha?
This smicha. Not a title. It has no...
It wasn't really my question.
Yeah. Okay. So then we answer, okay, gee, so we're now claiming that the reason we have to say that Gamliel is the Nasi is because he, in fact, was not the most qualified son. Rabbi Shimon was more qualified. So then we say, gee, so why did Rabbi Nasi appoint the oldest son if, in fact, he shouldn't have? And the answer is that Rabbi Shimon was wiser, but the son, Rabbi Gamliel, this is the third Rabbi Gamliel, the son of Rebbe, is more fearful of sin. And since the way we see Rabbi Shimon treating Levi is not so nice, right, this is a self-justifying claim. Okay. So we move on. Now we have a peculiar narrative about the claim of Barchama being the Rosh Hashiva. Here I have to say my translations may be off. I have difficulty translating some of the text here. I'm going to read it as straightforwardly as I can in English. Actually, the Hebrew and English aren't parallel right now because I had originally broken them separately. The way Sansino reads it, which is the way the text is certainly in some parallel manuscripts, but not in all, is that Rabbi Hanina refuses the position of Rosh Yeshiva because a Rabbi Ephes, who even though he sounds like Rabbi Zero, is in fact a real character elsewhere. So they didn't make him up just for this story. Rabbi Ephes is 2.5 years older than he. It's not entirely clear that's what the translation should be, but I can't really successfully parse the words any other way. But somehow, even though Rabbi Hanina does not accept the Rosh Yeshivahood, he still does not accept that Rabbi Ephes should be in place of him. So Rabbi Ephes becomes the head of the academy, and Rabbi Hanina sits outside the academy, right, which is the way of, in the Talmud, this Jeff Rubenstein, I think, points out very powerfully, basically all narrative in the Talmud takes place in the academy. Right? Every narrative pretty much takes place in the walls of the academy, and so if somebody wants to leave, what they do is they walk outside the academy. Right? That's walking off stage. So Rabbi Hanina is sitting outside, and there are a number of stories in which characters, because of political infighting in the academy, they go outside. My favorite one is the one at the end of Horiyot, in which the losers of an attempted coup d'etat, or coup d'academy, are forced to sit outside, and they lob paper airplanes in through the window with questions, and when the people inside can't answer them, they lob the answers in, and everybody comes outside because all the Torah is outside anyway. And that actually takes place with the same characters, Rishim and the son of Rebbe. But so here, Rabbi Chanina bar Chama sits outside, and Levi, whom we just met, sits outside with him. Now, it seems from the narrative that Levi does not sit outside with him because he thinks Rabbi Chanina bar Chama should be in charge. Levi sits outside because he thinks he should be in charge. Levi himself, yeah. But so his line, you know, did you really need to say that about Gamliel ben Nasi, is sort of an irony that he said that he figures that everything goes by connections anyway. And so, you know, so it's sort of a line, I'm never going to get to be this even though I really deserve it myself. So Levi and Rechina Barcham are sitting outside. And then one day Rabbi Ephes dies, Rabbi Chanina becomes head of the academy, and now Levi's stuck. He's got nobody to sit outside with. Because he really thinks he should be head of the academy. But he's not, right, but as long as Rabbi Chanina was with him, he had company. But he's not willing to be outside of that company. So Levi goes into exile. Right, he goes down to Babylonia, because it's lonely sitting outside by yourself. And that gets us into another segue, in which we are told that Rav, who's already in Babylonia, hears about Levi coming down and figures out that Rabbi Ephes must be dead, because otherwise Levi wouldn't be here. And they ask, well, gee, maybe Rabbi Chanina is dead, and that's why Levi has no one to sit with. And the answer is that since Rabbi Yehuda Nasi had declared that Rabbi Chanina would be Rosh Yeshiva, there's no way he would ever have died without that coming true. Rabbi had said on his deathbed, Rabbi Chanina bar Chama is going to be Rosh Yeshiva. So it couldn't be that Rabbi Chanina bar Chama died without being Rosh Yeshiva, because God upholds everything the righteous say. So we see that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi has, you know, is assumed to have this power over God. But he made this statement, it won't, right, God wouldn't let him die. Okay. So now the Talmud says, you know, right, having finished this tangent, the Talmud says, why in heaven did Rabbi appoint Rabbi Chanina bar Chama? He had Rabbi Chiya, who we all know was the greatest of his time. The Talmud says, oh, no problem. Rabbi Chiya was dead. So now we get into a late parrot routine. You all know the late parrot routine from Monty Python? It's the reverse, right? You know, the late parrot routine is, you know, is, I think he's dead. No, he's just sleeping, right? If he's sleeping, why is he nailed to the perch, right? the Talmud says, he didn't appoint Rabbi Chiya because Rabbi Chiya was dead. He says, gee, that's funny, because Rabbi Chiya said, I was at the grave of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, and I cried over it. So we say, no, no problem. Switch the names. Really, it was Rebbe who said, cried at Rebbe Chia's grave. We say, ah, fun. But Rebbe Chia also said that on the day that Rebbe died, all holiness was nullified in Israel. No, no problem. Let's switch the names. Okay. Now we have another story. When Rebbe was sick, Rebbe Chia came to visit him. Okay, and now this becomes thematically important. So Rebbe Chia, and he finds that Rebbe Nasi is crying on his deathbed. And he says to him, "Why are you crying? Wait, why are you crying?" Now here we have an interjection. Now the Talmud, the way we have it, says, "Why are you crying?" And has Rebbe Chia now quoting a Braita. And the Braita says that if you says two things which may be relevant to Rebbe's condition. First of all, it tells you that it's a bad sign for you if you die crying. It's a good thing to die happy, right? And meaning a good thing means that you're probably going to heaven. It's a bad thing if you die crying. The other thing it says is that if you die of severe intestinal illness, that's a good thing. Because that's the last line. Because most people who are righteous die of severe intestinal illnesses. So,
wait, what do you see in intestinal?
The last line of the insert. So now the question is, when Rabbi Chia asks Rabbi, why are you crying? The way we have it in the Talmud, there are two reasons why he might be questioning it. One is, don't cry. It's a reversal of the omen. Since crying is a bad sign for you, it would be better if you were laughing. Right? So smile, because that way you're more likely to go to heaven, which seems to be confusing cause and effect. The alternative is, why are you crying? After all, you're dying of a severe intestinal illness, and that means you're probably going to heaven. Now, I'm not at all sure that this interjection belongs at all. I think this is an interjection in the text that's not original. And originally the text just said, it's just a very naive question, why are you crying? So Rebbe Nasi says, I'm crying about Torah and mitzvot. Which seems to mean that he is, that as opposed to the story about Kiddush, that he does not expect right, he does not want to die because what's involved in death is losing Torah and mitzvot. Okay.
But he won't be mitzvah.
He won't be mitzvah, right? He loses them, right? He's not.
But he still is planning to come back, but he won't be doing mitzvot.
And so that presumably this does not fit with the idea that he makes kiddush for people, because if he's not mitzvah, then he can't make kiddush for others.
For others, right.
Okay, so that Talmud says, gee, so this again seems to have Rabbi Chia alive at Rabbi's deathbed. So we have two suggestions. The first one, which we've just been building up to, is, oh, Seth, flip the names again. Right? This is how we're getting to the late parrot routine. But the other thing is an occasion for another